Hello and welcome to the Nesson Patriots podcast. I'm Doug Kai, joined as always by Zach Cox. Zach, how are you doing today?
Another day in paradise, Doug. How are you?
It feels like paradise in this podcast recording studio right now because it's kind of like a sauna in here, but I am doing well. Apparently, there's going to be a 9-part Tom Brady documentary on ESPN, Man in the Arena. I thought someone on Twitter sort of made a good point that, I mean, I understand the reference on Man in the Arena, but football players don't really play in arenas, so they probably could have come up with a slightly different title on this one, but it's sort of a self-produced 9-part documentary. I can't imagine that it's going to give too much new information, but there are going to be those little tidbits like there were in Tom vs. Time. What are your thoughts on this?
We'll watch, obviously, and there will be nuggets that come out that kind of reveal a little bit of the inner Tom Brady. But honestly, I can't get myself to be particularly excited for this, just because, as you mentioned, it's a self-produced project. You can really only get so much, so deep into a player when it is a self-produced project that he is kind of helming and running. It sounds like the production is going to be split between 199 Productions, which is Tom Brady's new production company, and Gotham Chopra's production company, which was the one behind Tom vs. Time. So this is basically going to be – yeah, which was also self-produced. So this is basically going to be an expanded Tom vs. Time. And it's going to be 9 parts, which I think is excessive. I saw the initial trailer. I thought it was like an America's Game type length thing. And I said, oh, okay, whatever. That'll be fine. No, they're going full Last Dance with this. And I don't know, man. I just have some Brady fatigue, but this isn't like Michael Jordan where people have been waiting years and years and years to finally hear his side of everything and to get the inside story on everything that went down. We've had a lot of Tom Brady content over the last couple of years between Tom vs. Time and just everything he's put out on social media and just kind of the way that the modern athlete promotes himself. We've seen the curtain has been pulled back many times on Tom Brady. So while this one will probably have some new nuggets and some new information and some interesting stuff, depending on who they talk to and how exactly it's going to be formatted. I don't know. It's, I can't get myself to get too fired up for it, honestly.
I wish that it was coming out 10 to 20 years after his career was over. Tom Brady's certainly deserving of a 9-part documentary, but when he's still in the midst of his career, assuming he will be when this comes out, I don't know. I'm with you. 9 parts does seem a little bit excessive when he's still, I mean, he's not in the middle of his playing career, but he's still in the midst of his playing career. So, like I said, I would have preferred this not be self-produced. I would prefer it not be 9 parts. But there are going to be those little nuggets that everyone's going to glom onto. And I'm personally just sort of excited that I don't have to watch this with such a keen eye that I'm going to have to dissect it and write about it like I would if he was still on the Patriots. Obviously, there's still going to be some of that, especially if it's during the offseason. But it won't be the same as if it would if he was still the quarterback of the Patriots. Just as kind of an aside, I discovered that Tom Brady has tweeted 199 times, and now I'm stuck here sitting wondering if Brady deletes a tweet every time he tweets, so that's stuck at 199. It seems like way too big of a coincidence for me to look at how many tweets Tom Brady has and just see that it's 199 out of nowhere.
I think that's something that we're going to have to be monitoring over the we'll get our research department on over the next couple of days and see if that stays, because that's it's kind of corny, but it would be very on brand for Tom Brady to make himself always stay at 199 tweets. I hope that's actually the case. That would actually be kind of hilarious.
You mentioned The Last Dance. Obviously, that was the big documentary on Michael Jordan and the 90s Bulls that led to the question of what Patriots team would you like to see a Last Dance type documentary on? The first one that came to mind for me was the 2016 team. And that was the year that not only did the Patriots win the greatest Super Bowl in the history of the NFL, but it also was the year that Tom Brady started out the season with a 4-game suspension because of Deflategate. So the documentary could start out on Deflategate, get into obviously the season, Jimmy Garoppolo's still around. Maybe that's when some of the rift between Brady and Belichick really started. And then it gets into the Super Bowl against the Atlanta Falcons and the 28-3 comeback, all of that. A lot of big personalities on that team. What they had Martellus Bennett that year. So that would certainly be fun to hear what he has to say about the team years down the road. But that was the one, that was the team that initially came to my mind for that sort of documentary. Which team would you like to see that sort of documentary on?
I think the 2016 team is kind of the obvious pick if you want, if you're looking for a, one, a very compelling season, and two, just kind of a, if you're kind of trying to distill the Patriots into one season, it's probably the 2016 season, especially because the earlier seasons, the early dynasty years have already been kind of chronicled many, many times in specials and books and articles and whatnot. I think the 2016 season is probably your best bet. But if I could pick an honorable mention, I would say the 2017 season is probably an underrated pick for this, because you have, you mentioned that, I mean, most of the Deflategate stuff is died down by this point, but you have the Jimmy Garoppolo trade, which came out of nowhere for a lot of people. You have the Super Bowl that the Patriots lost and that Malcolm Butler did not play in. If you can potentially have this further enough, far enough in the future that you can get some actual real kind of reactions from a lot of the players and coaches involved in that moment. And just that whole 2017 season was a very compelling season overall. I mean, a lot of the games and a lot of the moments in that year are kind of not really remembered too well by Patriots fans just for the way the season ended, but there were some phenomenal games in that season. The Jacksonville game and the AFC Championship game was a fantastic game. Some of the games earlier in the season. And then from an off the field perspective, 2017, or I think more technically January 2018, but during that season was when that first initial Seth Wickersham bombshell Patriots report about Tom Brady and Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft all came out. So getting to hear some honest thoughts from not even just those three, but other players from around the building of what was it like the day or two after that report came out? What were the conversations like during in the Patriots locker room, in the Patriots meeting rooms? Was it really a, oh, we just totally ignored the noise type thing? Or was, did that kind of pique some sort of feeling within the locker room? So there are a lot of different angles you can take a look at with that 2017 team. Doesn't quite measure up to 2016, but I think that would be another year that would be definitely compelling to get a little peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, basically, without getting too far into it, what I've heard on the Malcolm Butler benching is that actual story isn't that interesting, but getting the reaction down the road from players about the Malcolm Butler benching and how it affected the team and how it affected their ability to win that game certainly would be interesting, especially when I look at
the fact that it's, yeah, sorry, continue.
Especially when I look at this roster right now of some of the guys who 10, 20 years down the road could want to vent about that. Alan Branch, who was also benched in that game. Marquise Flowers, who doesn't let a mind go, doesn't let a thought go through his head without tweeting it out. So God knows what he would say about that when he actually can in a documentary. James Harrison was on that team. Eric Rowe, who always spoke his mind. Kenny Britt. So certainly a very interesting team. And one other thing about that, just before we move on here, is that was also the year that Julian Edelman and Dante Hightower were injured, and that obviously played a massive part in the Patriots not winning a Super Bowl that season.
Absolutely, and I think the fact that there, to the best of our knowledge, isn't really a great story or a compelling story behind the Malcolm Butler situation might even make that more interesting, just to hear right. guys' reactions to say, this guy got benched for not some off-field scandal, but just because that's what they wanted to do. I don't know. It would be interesting to hear some retrospective of that 10, 20 years down the line.
So Patrick Chung signed a contract extension since the last time that we recorded a podcast. Most interesting thing about this to me is the fact that he reportedly, according to Jeremy Feller of ESPN, was considering retirement before re-upping for two seasons with the Patriots. He's now locked up through 2023. He'll be 36 years old. I cannot imagine him actually playing that long. The move freed up $925,000, according to ESPN's Mike Reese. If the Patriots had let Chung retire, it would have freed up somewhere around $3 million. I don't know. I don't love this move to sign Chung to an extension. I know it freed up enough cap room for them to sign Kyle Duggar, but it also just seems a little bit short-sighted that, okay, we need cap room to sign Kyle Duggar. Let's convince Patrick Chung to not retire and lock him up for two more years, which is just going to push that cap hit down the road. And sure, the Patriots will have more cap room when that does finally hit the books. But I think the Patriots probably could have got by during the 2020 season with Adrian Phillips, Terrence Brooks, and Kyle Duggar at that second safety spot. Might not have been quite as strong, but Chung was also showing signs of slowing down last season. He's been dealing with a lot of injuries over the last few years. And I don't know. I mean, if the guy was already considering retirement, he's already been banged up, he already took a step back last season, I think that he'll be an improvement over Phillips, Brooks, and Duggar. But I'm just not sure if that's a $2 million type improvement. Maybe it is. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, $2 million isn't that much, but it just seemed a little sentimental and short-sighted to me.
Yeah, I mean, nobody disputes the importance that Patrick Chung has had to this franchise for a long time, and Bill Belichick obviously loves him, but he has looked like a player in decline really over the last two seasons, just dealing with a lot of injuries, isn't nearly as dominant against tight ends as he was 3, 4, 5 years ago. And as you mentioned, he reportedly was considering retirement. So if a guy's considering retirement, he's probably not going to stick around for another 2, 3, 4 years. I mean, he's probably going to retire next offseason, you would assume, unless he has some kind of big change of heart. So it was a little bit of a curious situation, especially because there were some other ways that the Patriots could have opened up this cap space. They're not in a great spot from a salary cap perspective, obviously, but there are some other moves, some potential extensions, some potential releases that they could have made to open up even a little bit more space, because as you mentioned, it was less than $1 million. It was basically just enough to sign Kyle Duggar, and the Patriots still need to make further moves at some point to free up some additional space, because a team can enter a regular season with $300,000 in cap space or whatever it is they have right now. You need at least $4 or $5 million, preferably, to give yourself some buffer room for the inevitable injuries and midseason pickups and trades or waiver wire pickups or anything like that. So they're going to have to make additional moves anyway. A bit of an odd move. And it seems a little un-Belichickian, honestly, just given the way that Patrick Chung has, where he seems to be in his career, doesn't seem like the level that Bill Belichick usually goes out and extends a guy.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, say a player hits injured reserve, just signing a guy off the practice squad eats up, what, $500,000 worth of cap room, something like that. So, yeah, you absolutely need more than just some pocket change heading into the season. One report that came out on Wednesday was the reason why former Patriots wide receivers coach Chad O'Shea was fired as Miami Dolphins offensive coordinator. He went to Miami with their head coach Brian Flores from the Patriots, and it caught a lot of people by surprise when O'Shea was fired. It came out, a lot of details came out on why he was fired. It was that the offense that he brought over from the Patriots was too complex for the Dolphins to learn in such a short time span. I feel like we had sort of already heard that, but maybe there was just more details that came out about it on Wednesday. We don't want to get, you know, too deep in the weeds on the Dolphins, but I think this does apply to the Patriots, especially heading into the 2020 season. I wrote about this on Thursday morning. And so, I mean, the Patriots have a truncated offseason. They lost Tom Brady, and they're either going to have Jarrett Stidham or Brian Hoyer at quarterback. They've got two new tight ends in their offense. Guys like N'Keal Harry, Jacoby Myers, and Mohamed Sanu were kind of swimming last season trying to learn the offense. Plus, they lost offensive line coach Dante Scarnecchia. They're moving their assistant quarterbacks coach to wide receivers, and they're bringing in Jed Fish to be their new assistant quarterbacks coach. And Jed Fish has seemingly never worked in an Earhart Perkins offense. So he really was only ever in West Coast or spread or pro style college schemes. So he's a guy who is having to learn the offense himself. I think the Patriots and Josh McDaniels would really benefit from simplifying their offense a little bit. I'm not quite sure how that's done. I think really what it takes is shortening the playbook, because it was getting excessively large with Tom Brady at quarterback. then also just maybe simplifying some of the more complex parts of the offense. I know that one of those is the option routes the Patriots run. They sort of still need those to run their offense, but maybe they can scale them back a little bit. And one thing is that if Jarrett Stidham is the quarterback in 2020, as we all expect him to be, I think the offense will look different in general, because Jarrett Stidham didn't test overly well, but he's a pretty mobile quarterback. And he, if you even go back to his high school, college, preseason, training camp, he's not afraid to use his mobility as well. I think that he's got some pretty good vision as a scrambler. So I think that he could be used on bootlegs, rollouts, maybe some read option plays, maybe some RPOs, and that stuff the Patriots were not doing with Tom Brady. So if they're adding those elements into their offense, then they probably can scale back the complexity a little bit.
Yeah, I think it'll be kind of focusing on limiting the number of split-second decisions that all of their young players have to make at the same time. Basically, playing receiver in the Patriots offense, or at least the one that they've run for the last 20 years, is extremely difficult, because they basically need to find out what kind of defense the defense is running, and then, oh, if the safety's here, I run a slant. But if the safety's here, then I run a fade. If the safety's here, then I kind of do a little comeback. Like, there are just so many decisions that young receivers aren't used to making, especially ones that are coming from more simplified spread type college offenses like N'Keal Harry was last year. I think even if Tom Brady did come back this season, I think the Patriots would have benefited from finding a way to streamline and simplify that system a little bit, just because of how disjointed everything looked last year. There reaches a point where you have to say, okay, everybody on the team isn't going to know this offense as well as Julian Edelman and James White do, so we're just going to have to adapt to what we have. Now that Tom Brady's gone, that was going to happen naturally. I mean, you can't expect Jarrett Stidham to have anywhere close to the level of kind of institutional knowledge or game knowledge that Tom Brady had. And then you add on top of that all the other kind of coaching staff shuffling and personnel shuffling, all the new tight ends coming in, a bunch of new wide receivers coming in. I think the Patriots offense is going to look very different this season, at least in the early going. I don't think they're going to go full Jacoby Brissett and just basically run like a high school offense like they did for that one game against the Texans a couple of years ago, but they would really benefit from just kind of limiting the number of decisions that all of these guys have to make in a splits in kind of basically in real time. Yeah. And just find a way to let them play a little bit. And I think that could end up benefiting them. I mean, I know you've written about that a lot, but for guys like Jacoby Myers and N'Keal Harry, and guys that are coming into the system this year, like Dalton Keene and Devin Asiasi, if any of these undrafted receivers make the team, I think it's going to benefit them to, one, play with a quarterback who probably won't be quite as demanding as Tom Brady, and two, play in a system that is probably going to be a little bit more lenient with what they have to do on each play.
One of my bolder takes is if Jarrett Stidham is a starting quarterback in 2020, he will finish this season with a better passer rating than Tom Brady did in 2019. We'll see if it happens. Speaking of undrafted rookie wide receivers, let's get into some of our, we did film reviews on the Patriots, really five most intriguing undrafted free agents. We'll do five more next week as well, but we're about to get into Auburn wide receiver Will Hastings, Miami wide receiver Jeff Thomas, Arizona running back J.J. Taylor, Louisiana Tech quarterback Jamar Smith, and Michigan State quarterback Brian Lewerke. I did the Will Hastings film review. This is one of my favorite undrafted free agents the Patriots have signed going back, really, because, I mean, not only because pat myself on the back, I was the one who broke the signing, but also because he was a player who I really noticed last offseason when he was playing with Jarrett Stidham. I thought they had great chemistry. He looks like Wes Welker, and that's not just the usual cliche of every undersized slot receiver looks like Wes Welker. He was wearing a number 33 jersey, kind of catches the ball the same way. And really the most impressive trait that he has to me was his ability to seamlessly catch the ball and fluidly move up the field and immediately accelerate. And not only all of that, but also know where he was going to pick up yards after the catch. The biggest issue here, besides his size, which is 5'10", 175 pounds, is the fact that after the 2017 season, he tore his ACL in March of 2018. He tried to come back, had another surgery in October, was not nearly as productive in 2019. And it's a small sample in 17 and 19, but he didn't look quite as quick last season as he did when he was working with Jarrett Stidham. So maybe that is because of the knee injuries. Maybe it's because he was playing with a better quarterback in Jarrett Stidham in 2017. But the one good thing, and we'll obviously get a chance to watch him at some point, whether that's training camp, preseason, or whatever, he did test very well in his agility drills. I think he ran like a 6.5 three cone. He ran like a 4.1 or 4.0 something short shuttle. So those are very, very quick times in those drills. And that says to me that his knee might be feeling better now than it was during the season, but we'll really just have to wait to see. But the chemistry that he had with Jarrett Stidham, I think, will really pay off once these guys actually do get into practice.
Yeah, Hastings, when he did come back to the field this past season, wasn't particularly productive. I believe he only had something like 17 catches last year at Auburn. But as you mentioned, he was working with a freshman quarterback and was coming off knee surgery. So you'd have to think that at this point in a more familiar situation, I mean, this guy is going to be in Jarrett Stidham's wedding. I mean, these are very, very close friends and guys who worked very closely together. And he certainly fits the mold of what the Patriots are looking for in a slot receiver. So definitely going to be an exciting guy to watch this summer, assuming we can get out there.
He actually looks even younger than Gunnar Olszewski did last year. when people say that a player looks like a water boy, Will Hastings legitimately looks like a water boy.
I mean, he came into college as a walk-on onside kick specialist. Yes. He didn't even start playing wide receiver at the college level until a little ways into his Auburn career. So yeah, definitely doesn't really look the part of an NFL player, but he definitely has been productive in the past.
You did the film review on Jeff Thomas, wide receiver out of Miami. I did sort of a feature-ish type thing on him last week, but I'll let you talk first on Jeff Thomas. What'd you notice from your film review on him?
Jeff Thomas has the highest upside of anyone in this undrafted free agent class, this Patriots undrafted free agent class, maybe even the highest upside of any Patriots rookie. I mean, if this guy reaches his potential, he has serious number one deep threat talent. He is this is Jeff Thomas coming into college at Miami, was the number five wide receiver recruit in the country. And even though he didn't totally put it together at Miami, you watch some of his games and he looks like an absolute superstar. I mean, turn on his LSU game from 2018, his Virginia Tech game from this past season, and he's just making absurd catches, spinning guys out of their shoes downfield. He's got really good ball skills, really good speed, really good maneuverability and evasiveness downfield. So that's the good. The bad is, and the reason that the Patriots were able to sign him for a contract that included just $2,500 in guaranteed money, is that he's got some serious character concerns. He was kicked off the team once at Miami by former coach Mark Richt, was reinstated by Manny Diaz, Richt's successor, and then was suspended again last season, and then chose to enter the NFL and skip his senior year. These have been issues that go back all the way to his high school career at East St. Louis, a really rough neighborhood in Illinois, right outside St. Louis. It was actually a really good documentary about his final season at East St. Louis called 89 Blocks that I recommend anybody check out if they haven't yet. It's on, I think it's on foxsports.com. It was a Fox Sports Sports Illustrated feature. And it really just kind of painted the picture of just Jeff Thomas as a wildly talented but frustratingly unreliable player. A lot of his character concerns are just kind of, they all seem to be football based. It's just a lack of focus, a lack of commitment, missing practices, kind of sparring with coaches, stuff like that, that his high school coaches weren't able to rein in, and neither of his college coaching staffs were able to rein in. So now he will be with the Patriots. He's really starting from the ground level with the Patriots. He can walk in to the office the first day, Bill Belichick can say, "We gave you $2,500. That's literally nothing to an NFL program. If you step out of line at all and we don't think that you have what it takes, you're gone. Then that's it, and no skin off our back." So he's really going to have to prove that he can kind of fully buy into this Patriots system, especially since, as you alluded to earlier, this offseason is going to feature much less actual hands-on in-person work where the coaches are going to be on your back nonstop. Jeff Thomas, until the Patriots are allowed to get into the facility, is going to be asked to kind of tasked with doing a lot of this himself. He's going to have to be proactive. He's going to have to be a self-starter with the meetings, with learning the playbook. And that's going to be a lot to ask for a player who hasn't really proven that he's been able to do that in the past. And just one more point on his actual on-field contributions, even though he has those games where he looks like a future Pro Bowler, he wasn't able to contribute consistently over his 3 years at Miami. He would be great for a game or two and then kind of disappear. Over his career there, 3 year career, was a full-time contributor all three years, 83 catches, 1300 yards, in just one season last year, Jacoby Myers, or his final season at NC State, 92 catches, over 1,000 yards. So not the type of production that you expect to see for a guy as talented as he is, a guy as good on the deep balls and as just freakishly athletic as he is, hasn't been able to put it all together. If he does, he can be a really, really good player for the Patriots. But his history suggests that he won't. But he's definitely worth taking a risk on, especially with how cheap he was.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, being an undrafted free agent, getting the $2,500 signing bonus could be a way to humble him a little bit, because came from a tough background. East Illinois, East St. Louis is no joke. But, I mean, he was the best player on his high school team. He was a four-star recruit, like you said, number five wide receiver in the country, ahead of guys like Henry Ruggs. I think he was ahead of CeeDee Lamb. So he was, you know, kind of hot stuff, for lack of a better word, at Miami. And they sort of treated him that way, too. I mean, the fact that he was kicked off the team and then Manny Diaz brought him back might not have been the best thing for him, because that just, you know, gave him another reason to say, okay, well, I can do things my way and there will be no real repercussions for them. He got suspended during his junior season, then, like you said, left for school. But maybe this is finally a wake-up call that, you know, he was such a major recruit coming out of high school. He went undrafted and he got a smaller signing bonus than the guy we were just talking about, who was a walk-on onside kicker at Auburn, who was like a six-year college player. I mean, like, that's where he's at it right now. So he's starting from the bottom. I think that can only really benefit him at this point.
Yeah, for comparison, Will Hastings, 57,000 guaranteed. Isaiah Zuber, one of the other undrafted wideouts, 100,000 guaranteed. And Sean Riley, 15,000 guaranteed. So Thomas received significantly less than all three of those players, despite having, in my opinion, a much higher ceiling than all three.
Definitely. Next guy is Arizona running back J.J. Taylor. To my knowledge, he's tied as the second shortest player in NFL history. I went through a lot of research, Googling on Pro Football Reference, everything. There was a player named Jack Shapiro, who was a 5'1" fullback for the Staten Island Stapletons in 1929, only played one or two games. Taylor is 5'5" 1/4", which is the same height as Trindon Holiday, the former wide receiver out of LSU. Besides that, I cannot find another player who's under 5'5.5". There have been a lot of shorter running backs through the years. Darren Sproles is one. Deion Lewis, who's probably the closest comp for J.J. Taylor, Jaquizz Rodgers, you can get into guys like Tariq Cohen, Chris Thompson, Maurice Jones-Drew, but J.J. Taylor is shorter than all of them, only 185 pounds. I like him, though, and, you know, he's really one injury or one cap casualty away from earning a spot on the Patriots 53-man roster, because he's the number six running back on this team right now, behind Sony Michel, Damian Harris, Rex Burkhead, James White, and Brandon Bolden. So really, if something happens to those guys, J.J. Taylor's the next one up. He's got some really good pass-catching skills. He's got really soft hands. I like the way that he catches the ball and moves upfield. He was kind of more of a power runner in college, which obviously won't translate to the NFL at 185 pounds, but he also did certainly show some wiggle, maybe not to the same degree as Deion Lewis, but there was one play, I forgot who it was against, he had three defenders in his face, and he basically just juked his way out of it to pick up some sort of yardage. There were other plays where he kind of, you know, broke guys' ankles. Like I said, he isn't quite as quick or agile as a guy like Deion Lewis, but they're actually pretty similar in the fact that they're so low to the ground. They've got such good balance, and they really use it to their advantage.
I got to pick myself up a Staten Island Stapletons t-shirt. That sounds awesome. But yeah, yeah, no, that was kind of the general sense I got from watching Taylor too. You watched more of him than I did because you did write this story, but he definitely seems like a shorter, more powerful Deion Lewis. You see shades of what Lewis was able to do both as a runner and in the passing game, but you don't really see the kind of hyper jump cuts that Deion Lewis is really known for. You see more of a power back, which is strange for a back that is his size, for a 5'5" guy to be running people over out there. And the Patriots, every year they bring in an undrafted running back to basically just kind of carry the load throughout the preseason. It was LaShun Daniels a couple of years ago. It was Ralph Webb was in there. Who was the one last year? I can't even remember.
He was an LSU guy.
Nick Brissett. It's always a pretty nondescript guy. I feel like J.J. Taylor has a little bit more buzz, yes, and a little bit more excitement than a lot, yes, of those guys. He was a guy that, just monitoring draft Twitter, a lot of people thought would be a late round pick and were a little surprised that he went undrafted. So definitely has a little bit more upside than a lot of the players the Patriots typically use in this role.
One final note on him is that I kind of ran the PF, Pro Football Reference has a stat called approximate value. I sort of ran that stat on every running back who was invited to the combine from 2000 to 2017. And running backs who were 5'7 and below had the lowest approximate value, which is probably unsurprising. Running backs who were less than 190 pounds had the lowest approximate value, which also wasn't surprising. The one thing that was weird to me was that the real outliers were running backs who were 6'1" and 240 pounds plus. Those guys had approximate value of 23 and 22.2. So if a team's looking for a running back, you got a pretty good shot of hitting on someone who's 6'1", 240 pounds. Instead, the Patriots signed the guy who's 5'5", 185 pounds. But yeah,
LeGarrette Blount is just fist pumping somewhere right now.
Yeah, LeGarrette Blount, Leonard Fournette was like right around that range. Derrick Henry, obviously. Saquon Barkley's a taller running back. So, Jeremy Hill was another one who was in that mold. But let's get into quarterbacks now. You studied Louisiana Tech's Jamar Smith. Real quick, what'd you see out of him?
He was a guy that I'm a little surprised we didn't hear anything about leading up to the draft. This was a quarterback that he wasn't invited to the combine and really just wasn't even on on the national radar whatsoever. But he was productive at Louisiana Tech, a three-year starter there, completed 64% of his passes last season, 18 touchdowns, 5 interceptions, only threw interceptions on 1.3% of his passes last year, which is a pretty solid number there. Reminded me a little bit of Jordan Love when I was watching him on tape, the first-round draft pick of the Green Bay Packers. He really excels on those off-platform throws, whether it's on design rollouts or whether he's just kind of scrambling to avoid the rush. There were a lot of plays where he just kind of he made a throw that it doesn't look like a player should be able to throw that it doesn't look like a player should be able to make without his feet set. He'd be throwing with 1 foot on the ground, up in the air, doing all this crazy stuff, and it was impressive. It wasn't even a one-hit wonder type thing. He did that pretty consistently over the course of the season in the games that I was able to watch. Now, obviously he's a quarterback who went undrafted, so there are some significant flaws in his game. His field vision and decision-making can definitely use some work. He showed too often he would kind of lock onto a receiver, and you can tell in his mind, he's saying, all right, I'm throwing it to number 15 on this play, no matter what. And while that didn't typically lead to interceptions, there were a lot of plays that he was just kind of forcing into tighter coverage than he should. He had one play against Texas, which was actually the only game he lost as a starter last season, where Louisiana Tech was on the 6 or 7 yard line, and he just threw the ball into about 7 Texas defenders. I have no idea what he was trying to do on the play. I think he was trying to get it to a running back. Somehow it didn't end up getting intercepted, but plays like that are what you're going to have to eliminate from your game if you want to make it with the New England Patriots. But overall, as I mentioned, I'm surprised that he didn't get a little bit more buzz going into the draft. I didn't watch it and come away with saying, oh, this guy should have been a third, fourth round pick. The Patriots got a total steal. But he's definitely got some tools. He's definitely got some talent. He's got some upside that makes him a much more intriguing prospect, in my opinion, than Brian Lewerke, the Patriots' other undrafted quarterback. But I mean, he does have two issues that I identified or that I noted as reasons why he might have been kind of teams might have stayed away from him in the pre-draft process. Was suspended last year for two key games late in Louisiana Tech's season. As I mentioned, he went 10-1 as a starter last year. Louisiana Tech lost both of the games that he was suspended for, which ended up costing them a spot in the Conference USA Championship game and a potential New Year's Six Bowl. Because if he had played and they'd won those two games, I believe they would have finished the year 11-1. That's a pretty compelling case. They could have taken the spot that Memphis ended up getting in the Cotton Bowl, I believe it was. Not exactly sure what the reason for the suspension was. It was a unspecified team rules violation. But especially if you're a quarterback, that can't happen. I mean, suspensions for the
hefty
quarterback position.
Too. Two games is hefty.
Yeah, two-game suspension at that critical point in the season. And when maybe it's unfair, but quarterbacks have to be held to a higher standard. You're the senior leader of a team that has kind of playoff or big-time bowl game aspirations, and you can't get suspended for two games. That definitely is a gigantic red flag there. And then the other thing is, even though he played very well in his first game back from suspension, his bowl game was pretty terrible, honestly. It was his worst game of the season by far. He had two touchdowns in the game, passing touchdown, rushing touchdown. Louisiana Tech beat Miami, but only completed 46% of his passes, had some really just bad overthrows. He was sailing passes over guys' heads, which had been pops up on some of his other tapes, but wasn't really a big issue until this game against Miami. Also showed some really poor pocket presence, just not seeing pass rushers, not seeing blitzers, stuff like that. Stuff that really looks pretty dissimilar from the rest of his tape. So not sure what the reasoning behind that was, but I think those definitely kind of tanked his draft stock a little bit. But again, he's got upside. He's going to be an intriguing guy to watch. Also has some mobility, not a Lamar Jackson type, but a guy that can move around in the pocket a little bit and make some plays with his legs. So overall, he's an exciting prospect. I'm glad that the Patriots picked up a quarterback like this, just because I think he'll be fun to watch this summer and has an outside chance of sticking around as that third quarterback.
The quarterback that I studied was Michigan State's Brian Lewerke. Patriots also signed him as an undrafted free agent. And I'm not expecting much out of Lewerke, to be honest. His best traits are his deep ball accuracy, completed almost 50% of his deep passes in 2019 with 6 touchdowns and 3 interceptions. His arm in general is NFL quality. He's got a strong arm. He can make all the throws. He can throw to the sideline. He can throw downfield. He's got a lot of zip. But his accuracy in the short area and in the intermediate is really lacking. His tape has a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde to it, where sometimes he looks like, you know, potentially a late round draftable quarterback. But then there are games like the one that he had against Wisconsin, where you wonder how that player even got signed by an NFL team. So I think the hope here is that the Patriots can kind of harness that big arm and maybe improve his accuracy. The problem is that it's a truncated off season, like we said earlier. So I really don't know if there's going to be enough time to do that. Ultimately, I think his best shot is on the practice squad. And that's only if the Patriots don't either sign Jamar Smith to their active roster or can't slip him onto the practice squad. Otherwise, I'm not seeing a lot out of Brian Lewerke. Never completed more than 60% of his passes. His touchdown to interception ratio in college was 47 to 32. As a junior, he had 8 touchdowns and 11 interceptions in 11 games. That was a really ugly season. He had an arm injury that year. He was better as a sophomore and as a senior, but I don't know. I mean, I really like his arm. He's got a good arm. He's pretty mobile. He only ran a 4.95, but he had some actually decent rushing ability where he could take off and go off for some long runs. But he also, on top of that, he also caught 4 passes for 32 yards in his college career, which is a lot for a college quarterback. But I don't know. I mean, with 4.95 speed, you're not going to get by with your mobility. Like his arm, but I don't love Lewerke really as a prospect.
Yeah, I was just going to mention Lewerke actually had more rushing yards than Jamar Smith in each of the last 3 seasons.
Yeah.
Even though Jamar Smith is considered more of a quote unquote dual threat quarterback, I don't think either of them are going to be revolutionizing the Patriots offense with their mobility. But it was interesting. That is another kind of interesting wrinkle that that Lewerke does have to work with. So,
and just one more thing on Lewerke is that reminded me. He's got a little bit of Jarrett Stidham in the fact that he's not overly athletic, but he's not afraid to take off with the ball. And it's also somewhat similar to Stidham, where they had really good, like they had a really good season early in their college career. And that was for Lewerke as a sophomore. Then they tailed off. And then for Lewerke, he kind of rebounded as a senior. It was to a lesser degree on his good season and to a much higher degree on the poor season. But there is a little bit of that Jarrett Stidham where mobile plus had a down season, but it was a down season for a reason. So I don't know, maybe they'll see something in him, but I personally don't have very high hopes for him. One final thing on this podcast, we did talk to Danny Vitale today on a conference call. He was talking about how he looks up to 49ers fullback Kyle Juszczyk. So let's just play that audio real quick.
He's kind of the player that I like to model my game after in terms of the versatility aspect. You know, different teams have different schemes and need their fullbacks to fill different roles. So obviously that's, you know, what your scouting departments are looking for is guys who can fill that role that they need. But I think he's a good guy to look up to.
Yeah, so just real quick on Danny Vitale, he's a lot more athletic than James Devlin, the retired Patriots fullback. People might be sort of overestimating how productive he can be by comparing him to Kyle Juszczyk, because Kyle Juszczyk is basically as productive as a tight end, even though he's at fullback, maybe a little bit less so. But I certainly don't see Danny Vitale finishing seasons with, you know, 30 or 40 touches by the end of it. But I could certainly see him being used more in the passing game than someone like James Devlin, just because he does have much more pass catching experience and he's a much better athlete than Devlin. At the same time, the Patriots, you know, might not get the same sort of lead blocking ability from him than they did out of Devlin.
Yeah, Kyle Juszczyk has had 20 plus catches and 200 plus receiving yards each of the last five seasons. Danny Vitale, even though he brings a lot of the, he's kind of in the same mold as Kyle Juszczyk. He has 15 catches for 145 yards and zero touchdowns in his entire NFL career, which is 4 years. Did make some nice plays with the Packers last season. He had three 20-plus yard completions, seven catches for 97 yards in that season. So he's got the potential. It could be a case of just the teams that he's played for haven't had the infrastructure or the desire really to use him in that way. I think Josh McDaniels will be interested in using him that way, either using him or using Dalton Keene, who's kind of a similar prospect, their third round draft pick. But as you mentioned, Vitale is extremely athletic. He tested in the 90th percentile or higher in basically every combine drill when he was coming out of Northwestern back in 2016. Was a reasonably productive receiver at Northwestern. He played a position called super back, which is kind of this hybrid between fullback, tight end, H-back, wide receiver, caught 135 passes for over 1,000 yards over the course of his career there. So he is experienced as a receiver. Since he's been in the NFL, he's kind of bounced between a bunch of different roles, it sounds like. Some of the teams he's been on wanted him to be that James Devlin lead blocker type, while other teams he's been on wanted to use him more as an H-back and use him a little bit more in the passing game. So he's got some potential. I don't think, as I wrote in my story about this, Patriots fans should expect him to come out there and be Kyle Juszczyk, but I do think that he can be more productive this year than he has been at any of his previous stops, just with the way that Josh McDaniels is able to use players in his offense and kind of unlock different areas of their skill sets that hadn't previously been kind of exploited by previous coaches and offenses. I mean, even James Devlin, who is not athletic and not a receiving threat whatsoever. No shade on James Devlin. He was phenomenal at what he did. Even he had 12 catches on 17 targets in 2018. So Josh McDaniels is willing to get his fullback involved in the passing game. And when the fullback is a guy like Vitale, who does have that kind of that receiving potential, I think they're going to find some creative ways to use him in there.
One last note on Vitale. Superback is such an absurd term for a player, like especially when it's like, in H-back, like it's just
that's,
like
over- that's college football though. College football has some like if you're ever
yeah like,
if
you love her and
yeah, yeah you watch the like the intros on I'm picturing the old like college football on ABC in my right. mind, but it's like here's the tight end and then here's the flanker and here's the split end and here's the slot and then on defense here's like the the monster and here's the right. especially on defense. They like to find ways for their like Nickelback to sound cool. So
well, yeah, I mean it's like a star or a, yeah, whatever term they use. Like Superback is for a glorified H-back, just like tone it down a little bit.
They're probably just didn't have enough guys to play it and they're like, you guys want to play Superback? Like, yeah, I want to play Superback. Let's go. Yeah.
Don't be a linebacker or a Superback. Yeah. All right. Well, that will do it for this week's Nesson Patriots podcast. Keep it on Nesson.com for all of your Patriots coverage. Follow Zach on Twitter at Zach Cox Nesson. Follow me on Twitter at Doug Kide. And we will be back next week talking about the next 5 undrafted free agents that we're studying, plus much more. It depends on what else comes out about the Patriots until then.